This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In too many schools across the country, the honors classes are all white, the remedial education courses all black. Experts say the racial achievement gap is there in kindergarten and widens through middle school. Why that is and how to fix it have been a puzzle for decades. This week, NPR's education reporter Claudio Sanchez did a two-part series on Morning Edition that explored this problem and some solutions that appear to be working, at least in one school. The black-white achievement gap is our focus for the remainder of this hour. Is it about economics, parental involvement, systemic racism in the educational system, or something else? If you're a teacher, a parent, or a student who's dealt with this issue, and if you have creative solutions in particular, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll start with Claudio Sanchez. He's with us here in Studio 3A, and thanks very much for coming in.
Good to be here.
First of all, what's the size of this achievement gap?
Well, it varies. Obviously, it depends on what you're measuring. SAT score averages, for example, overall are said to be anywhere from 200 to 300 points difference, meaning that...
Combined?
Combined.
Okay.
Of course, if you put a lot of faith in the SAT, that's pretty alarming. The other, though, is the GPA, often by as many as 1 to 2 grades, grade point average. Then there are other kinds of gaps that people point to, the graduation gap, for example, dropout data, all kinds of things that reflect academic achievement, academic persistence, and by and large, black students don't do as well as whites.
As we said earlier, it's a dilemma. There's not been a lot of research on this. Educators know little about why it happens, so why do they think it happens?
Well, for all kinds of reasons, although let me give you just a little bit of history, Neil. The black-white gap became a huge issue, first of all, right after 1954 and the desegregation of
Brown
schools.
Brown versus Board of Education.
Exactly. It was something that the southern states pointed to and, in fact, pretty much began to publish test scores of black and white students saying, look, this is going to water down, integration is going to water down the academic curricula, and it's going to show in the end that white students are much better prepared and that, for whatever reason, black students don't achieve as well. So that should justify the continued segregation of school children. But shortly thereafter, what happened was that public education began to look at what was called remediation or compensatory education. Mm-hmm. First in St. Louis, Missouri was one of the first school systems to do this, and then New York City shortly thereafter, so that by 1965, when you had the enormous amount of federal policy in education, there were already many compensatory education models all geared to raising the level of achievement of black children. Now, the research since then has been very mixed. Researchers have essentially found that there is some connection to socioeconomics. Black underachievement generally has been tied to poverty, parents' low educational levels, few resources at home, early reading, or little early reading, compounded by the fact that black children, by and large, more so than black students, I should say black children more so than white students, attend inferior public schools. They have really poorly trained teachers. And what's, I guess, puzzling in recent years is that because overall black family income has gone up and more flat families have gone into the middle and upper middle class communities, you know, you'd still find this gap there, and therein lies this controversy.
So even the children of black families from more or less the same socioeconomic class as white families, there's still a gap.
Precisely, although, again, here you have to look at certain communities, not overall.
Right. Okay. Let's get a question in. This is Raul, who's on the line with us from New York City. Raul, got to turn that radio down. And we can hear the delay there. Raul, you've got to turn the radio down.
Hello?
Yes, you can't be listening to the radio. You got to be listening on the phone, Raul.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Basically, my question is, I'm a little heartened that the person being interviewed is Latino. I'm a Latino, and it's always black and white. It's always black and white. We as a minority, even though we're more numerous than blacks, we seem to be ignored, and nobody's even talking about how Latinos are doing.
Is there an achievement gap with Latinos, Claudio?
There certainly is. Raul, this is Claudio Sanchez again. Listen, it's a legitimate point you raise. Clearly, though, the dynamics of this gap within the Latino community, namely in the Spanish-speaking community, is very different than the black-white gap. It's just a very different dynamics there. But you're right. I mean, the Latino gap exists for all kinds of reasons. Keep in mind that in the Latino community, you know, much of that gap is due directly to first-generation immigrants' children who don't speak English.
Well, thank Raul for his question and point out that in another large immigrant community, the Asian community, there is less of an achievement gap, and indeed Asian children do pretty well in school.
And there, Neil, you're pointing to perhaps one of the more mysterious, if not complicated, issues in this whole question, because what some researchers that I've talked to have said is that, look, here we're dealing with an immigrant community where there are cultural issues at stake, although some of the people who've done long-term research of the Asian community point to disparities, academic disparities in Japan, for example, mm-hmm. among Asian immigrants and between some Asians and Japanese communities.
Let's get another caller, and this is Elizabeth, who's with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I work for a charter school system, but I also have a law degree, and it seems to me that just based on my observations from having gone through high school and undergrad and law school and now working in education, that a big part of the problem is low expectations. When I was in law school, my school had an awards program that gave academic awards to minorities who did well. And the standard for doing well academically was a 3.5. Now, if you were not a minority, if you were white, the standard for doing well was like 3.9.
Mm-hmm.
And the expectation was that, well, minorities automatically can't really achieve that well. And when I talk to some of our black parents, and they don't seem to be upset when their very intelligent children are getting C's and D's, they do get upset when the teacher won't give them a grade so they can play on the sports teams. It just seems to me the expectations in the community itself are not as high as they should be. And unfortunately, I think that's the big white elephant no one wants to talk about. It's a cultural expectation difference.
Claudia?
Well, I think that the caller is really raising the what some researchers call the disengagement of black families in this case. John Ogbu, an anthropologist trained at UC Berkeley, did a very, very interesting study out of Shaker Heights right outside Cleveland, Ohio, where he essentially, you know, concluded that the kind of disengagement that the caller is referring to was very much present in this very affluent upper middle class community. But it's not that, you know, clear cut. I mean, this academic disengagement, however you define it, has other tentacles to it. Often we're talking about, even in Shaker Heights, an affluent community, a black community that where most of these kids were coming from single parent homes, wealthy, successful parents, but nonetheless, you know, not two parent homes. There's a lot of this research that has actually failed to explain why middle and upper middle class high school students, black high school students, for example, don't achieve. Why don't they set their standards as high as white kids do? And again, that's partly the part of the fault of the school and what the caller calls the low expectations in schools. It's been proven over and over again that a predominantly white, you know, what is it now? 90% of the teaching force is white, mostly female, has very low expectations of black children by and large. And that obviously manifests itself in the classroom.
And could be self-reinforcing.
It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, you white teachers who say, you know, we're not going to be able to keep this kid on such a stringent or on such a high rigorous coursework, so we're going to do him a favor and give him something less.
Elizabeth, thank you. Oh, I'm sorry, do you have another?
Well, I was just going to say, we actually had a couple of families pull their children from our school, and these were educated, affluent families who, you know, parents who had graduate and postgraduate education, because we would not lower our expectations for what was required of their children because their children were black. and they actually pulled their kids from it. And it was very, very frustrating to us as educators because we kept thinking, why aren't you expecting the best from your kids? And I just think that is a big chunk of the problem. And unfortunately, I don't know what the answer is, and I'm not sure anybody does.
Elizabeth, thanks.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate the phone call. And let's see if we can get another call in here with Claudia. This is Zell, who's with us from Stockton, California.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to, I had a comment. I am a graduate of the class of 2001. I've been at junior college for 3 years, and I'm planning on attending Santa Clara University next fall. As a black student, I had a fairly decent GPA. It wasn't great. It was 3.4 in high school, and now I'm carrying a 3.7 as I get ready to transfer. But I, as your last caller was mentioning, there, from both black and non-black racial groups, there is a certain sense in the children that if you are studying and you choose to do more academic things as opposed to more more athletic things, that you are somehow not as black as the other kids. That was actually a big problem that I had up until the eighth grade, was that people don't think of me as a black kid. They think of me as Zell, the student, but not I can't. It hurts my race, I should say, that I would choose to do things like studying theater and studying English, and it had a really negative effect on me for the first couple of years. But then I realized that it wasn't that made me black, and it wasn't that made me what I was. It was what I chose. But I don't feel a lot of students are able to come to that conclusion themselves.
Zell, I just wanted to clarify, is this the phenomenon known, I think that's talked about as a pressure, it's acting white to be smart?
Yes, exactly. You know, my father used to tell me of this old saying that was said even in black neighborhoods, if it's not white, it's not right. And that's kind of the thing. That's kind of how I feel. It's not that same type of Jim Crow mentality, but somehow along the way, my generation picked up the fact that being black isn't equal to being book smart. You know, being mm-hmm. black isn't equal to being able to study and to be successful at academic things. And it is kind of alarming. But I think that that's a big part of this gap too. Is that most of the time when you do see, when you see successful black people, they're doing, most of the time it's a sport or something. But
mm-hmm. Well,
there's not enough credit, I guess. You don't see many people that go out of their way to focus on the multiple numbers of black CEOs in this country or, you know, black entrepreneurs.
Thanks very much for the call, Zell. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And good luck in college.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Claudio, this was another part of the Ogbu study in Shaker Heights that you mentioned.
In fact, John Ogbu, the anthropologist from UC Berkeley who was invited to Shaker Heights by black parents to study this gap, was the man, or one of those anyway, who coined the term acting white. One of the things about this issue, though, is that that I find interesting is that, you know, and I was told over and over again by black students at Shaker Heights and in other schools that I visited in Ohio, who said, look, we don't resent that other black kids are smart or that they're studying all the time, that they don't want to go out, that, they don't want to do what all the other kids want to do. We just resent that some of these kids, you know, rub it in our face. I mean, it came down to a very personal level, a very personal view that a lot of black kids who are very high achievers kind of disengage themselves from that, you know, black peer group. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you could argue that this acting white issue perhaps is overblown. On the other hand, you know, there is in high schools these days, in a typical high school, just as much, a criticism of the so-called nerds in schools as there is of black high achievers. I mean, it's an underlying climate in schools these days of saying, look, if you're achieving and you're working hard, you're somehow different from us, and therefore we're going to ostracize you. I mean, that's very common in high schools.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Claudio Sanchez, before we let you go, you did go to one other high school for this series on Morning Edition, where things seem to be working. Briefly, can you tell us what they're doing and how well it's doing?
Well, in a nutshell, and I guess people are often amazed by how simple things can be. This is a school system in just outside Columbus, Ohio, in Reynoldsburg school system, very much a bedroom community, suburban community. A high school there does not inherit a big black-white gap because by 10th grade, over 95% of blacks and 96% of whites are reading at or above the grade level. I mean, these are very high-achieving kids overall. And the same is true in math and science. You know, 84% of blacks performing at or above grade level, 92% of whites at or above grade level. Now, the system attracts a lot of good teachers, and it keeps good teachers. It's a huge, huge issue, a huge difference, certainly compared to other school systems across the state and in other parts of the country. I mean, if you keep good teachers, you've kind of halfway there. The other thing about this high school, though, was that all students had access to honors and advanced courses. The school offered early release and evening classes. It was very, very flexible. It literally did not give kids an excuse to fail. The best teachers didn't just teach the best students. And the black graduation rate at this school was actually higher than the white graduation rate. Something there was happening. And people in education will always tell you, look, it really does come down to the people running the show. I mean, we're talking about very dedicated administrators and educators who say, we're just not going to allow these kids to make any excuses or failure, regardless of your race. And the less the attention they pay to race, evidently, the more kids felt that, you know, there were no double standards and that everybody was expected to achieve. And I guess I came away feeling that there was a very good reason why this particular school system had the absolute smallest gap in white-black gap in the state of Ohio.
Claudio Sanchez, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Claudio Sanchez is an education reporter for NPR, and he was with us here in Studio 3A. And joining us now from her office here in Washington, D.C. is Amy Wilkins, a partner with the Education Trust, a national advocacy group that seeks to narrow the achievement gap between minority students and white people. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We just have Claudio kept me so long, I apologize. But as you were listening to his description of that high school outside of Columbus, Ohio, do you think that can be the culture of success that they're talking about in that school can be a model?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it, somehow we seem in this country to act as though the achievement gap is written in stone. We think the achievement gap is a choice rather than a fate. And I think it depends a lot on what our school systems and individual schools do. If you give minority and poor kids very good teachers and teach them to high levels, they achieve at high levels. And it sounds like that this school that Claudia was just talking about does exactly that.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, how serious is this gap?
Oh, the gap is tremendously serious. You know, I mean, Claudio talked some about that at the beginning of the show. But, you know, one sort of way to look at the gap is, you know, the national assessment of education progress tells us that the skills of black and Latino 17-year-olds are about the same as the skills of white 13-year-olds. That means you have black and Latino kids graduating from high school with the skills that white 8th graders have. That's a huge problem for them, and it's a huge problem for our society.
We're talking about the achievement gap between white and minority students. If you're an educator who's dealt with this issue, if you have thoughts about solutions, give us a call. We'll take more of your questions after we come back from a short break. The number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and today we're discussing the achievement gap between black and white students. Our guest is Amy Wilkins. She's a partner with the Education Trust, a national advocacy group that seeks to narrow the achievement gap for minority students. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is TOTN@npr.org. And Amy, as we continue talking about this, this gap, given the historic role that the federal government has in holding schools accountable for kids' performance, I guess the No Child Left Behind provision is the most recent, what can the federal government do to close this gap, do you think?
I think the federal government really needs to put pressure on states and school districts to solve the problem of the maldistribution of teachers between high minority school districts and low minority school districts, between low poverty school districts and high poverty school districts. I think, you know, teachers really are at the core of this, and what you find is that we systematically give low income and minority kids the least able teachers. That is, we give them the very newest teachers, we give them the rookie teachers while the veterans go off and teach in other school districts. We give them the teachers who are less likely to have degrees in the subject area in which they're teaching. And if the federal government really held states and school districts accountable for ensuring a fair distribution of talented teachers, I think it would go a long way to closing the achievement gap.
Let's get another caller in. This is Craig, who's with us from Cleveland Heights, Ohio.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, Craig.
Yes, I'm a teacher at the high school at Cleveland Heights, which is neighboring to Shaker Heights. And my subject area is vocal music. I have five choirs. Our school is 75% African-American. It doesn't matter to me what race or ethnicity the students are. I still hold the expectations the same. And because of that, these kids, when they go to state competitions, receive superior ratings. We have 6 to 8 students make the All-State Choir. They are the only African-American students in the All-State Choir throughout our state. We're also moving to the Knowledge Works Foundation, and we're going to small schools next year. But the bottom line, I reiterate with the other callers, is the expectations. As the sooner we hold all students to the same expectation level, the sooner the gap will be taken care of.
And when you say we, you mean teachers?
Yes, teachers and administrators. And I'm very fortunate in my system that the administration stands behind me and other faculty at our school about expectations and levels of kids. And that's why our kids are achieving and are making great strides in the area.
Well, what do you think about that, Amy Wilkins? Is low expectations a major part of the problem, and is high expectations a solution?
Low expectations are a huge part of the problem. You know, one of the things you find in schools serving low-income and minority kids is you hear repeatedly teachers saying, well, you know, she comes from a low-income family, and she only has one parent, and her community is disorganized and violent, and so we really can't expect her to, you know, fill in the blank, do algebra, do geometry, write a term paper, read To Kill a Mockingbird. And we systematically give low-income and poor kids good grades for work that wouldn't get a good grade at a white or more affluent high school. We send these kids very false signals about, you know, what is good enough. And, you know, in the previous segment, you had a lot of people calling in sort of saying that there's this disconnect and that to achieve at high levels is acting white. I don't know. I'm an African-American, and what I always heard in my household and in my community is that if you are African-American, you have to work twice as hard as the white kids if you want to get by. And that ethic, I think, is, you know, it prevails and needs to prevail in our schools.
Craig, thanks very much for the call.
I also agree with Amy, and luckily we have an African-American administration who stand behind that same philosophy, and I tell my kids that because you are black, you need to work harder.
Well,
if you walk in that door, it's how you present.
Okay, thanks very much again.
Thank you.
And an email to that point from Kathy in Ann Arbor. I went to a public school system known for being excellent. I'm an African American. I found it difficult to get into accelerated and advanced placement courses. I fought my way into them, but was always steered toward remedial classes. I ended up going to an Ivy League school. My grades also improved in law school, where grading is blind, meaning that the professors do not know who is being graded when they are grading the exams. What's being done about teachers and administrations in K-12 education steering minorities into remedial programs?
The Education Trust is doing a lot of work with school counselors now to try and get counselors to understand that their role really has to be to open up, honors classes and gifted and talented programs to African-American, Latino, and low-income students. Traditionally, the counselor's role has been as sort of a gatekeeper in keeping kids out of those classes. But we really have to ensure that those kids have equal access to those sorts of classes. When you talk about Shaker Heights and places like that, you often find, you know, affluent school districts that have black children and white children going to school together, but when you look more closely, you really have two separate schools within the same school. You have entirely white honors tracks, and you have the minority kids in the remedial tracks. And until we bust that up, we're not going to get the sort of high achievement that we know these kids are capable of.
Let's talk now with Eva, who's in a car here in Washington, D.C.
Hi. I just want to let you know that I am a former high school teacher, and I just want to reject the notion, first of all, that there are cultural influences that impact African-American low achievement. I think that's an insult, first of all. And second of all, if you look at how African-Americans responded directly after slavery, you'll see that they did everything they could to educate. I'd also like to reject the notion that economic issues are a problem, because when you look at African kids who are in Africa a lot less prominent than African-American kids are, they achieve at much higher numbers. But what I would say is the culprit here is the society and what popular culture shows these kids. As a former high school teacher, the kids that I saw, especially being African-American myself, I'm looking at them and I see that all they're doing is following what the television tells them they're supposed to do. The boys had to be funny or had to be vulgar. The girls had to wear one-fourth clothing, or they had to be completely idiotic in the way that they acted. And they just fell directly in line with popular culture, and I think that's something that we really need to take a look at.
Would you agree, Amy Wilkins?
You know, popular schools are not islands. They exist within the context of a larger society. But we cannot, educators cannot use the bad influences of popular culture to sort of let themselves off the hook for demanding more of their kids and for providing their kids with the resources that they need to achieve at high levels. So while I agree that we have to deal with popular culture, I think that's a huge and long battle, and we have to sort of immediately join the battle about improving student achievement and not let the larger culture be an excuse for not, you know, joining the fight for higher achievement for low-income and minority kids.
Eva,
yeah, I thoroughly agree on that. It's definitely not an excuse, but I just feel I feel for the parents, because parents have to compete against that, and my parents had to as well. Both my brother and I came from middle-class families, and they pushed education, but neither of us did as well as we could have as well. And
right.
So they just have parents have a lot to do, but they can do a lot more.
And so can the schools.
And Eva, if you don't mind my asking, why are you a former teacher?
Oh, I have a change in the education field. I'm actually in a different part of the field of education, but I'm still very much interested in it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and we appreciate
it. Okay.
And let's see if we can get Victoria in. She's calling from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I've been a teacher for 14 years in the inner city, mostly Latino, African-American students. I run a Saturday program as well. And I work with a lot of young children and families. I tend to go visit homes a lot just so I know what's going on with my kids. But I'll tell you, one of the single biggest problems we have with No Child Left Behind is a lot of my kids come to school, you know, with the bonus of having a second language, but we never capitalize on that in our school systems. We're always, you know, working subtractively. And one of the things I'd love to see is that if I could put every child that I teach right now in kindergarten in a preschool program from the age of 3, I think we'd make a lot of headway in the gap. I'm always, always trying to find spaces for my students before they come to schools and their brothers and sisters. And I rarely am lucky enough to do that.
Amy Wilkins, does that speak to the fact that there appears to be a gap even in kindergarten?
You warm my heart with that comment. Absolutely. We know that 90% of kids' brain development happens before they reach kindergarten. Too many of these kids are in situations that don't take advantage of this period of explosive intellectual growth. If we were really serious about boosting overall student achievement and closing the gap, we would ensure that every child in this country had access to high-quality pre-kindergarten programs.
Absolutely.
Victoria, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Amy Wilkins, we wanted to thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
Amy Wilkins is a partner with the Education Trust, a national advocacy group that seeks to narrow the achievement gap. And she joined us from her office here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. With us now is Lawrence Burnley, an ordained minister, a 1974 graduate of Shaker Heights High School. He's one of the volunteers with the Minority Achievement Committee and works with minority students at the high school. He joins us from his home in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, and thanks for being with us on Christmas Eve.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
Why did you decide to start volunteering?
Well, a couple of reasons. I am an alum, as you mentioned, of Shaker Heights, but two, my son, who is passed away 4 years ago, was a very active member of that group, functioning as a minority scholar, working with students who was underachieving at the time. And it's a way for me to give back to my community and to really carry on his legacy. His name was Rashad.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you have a program with him and try to inspire students in both education and with a philosophy of success. What do you tell them?
Well, I simply tell them that each day as they rise, that I invite them to look themselves in the mirror and make a commitment to give it the day and their effort, their best shot, to really strive toward excellence and to say at the end of the day that they really tried their best. And I think it's a philosophy I use with my son, that if they do that, I think in terms of the grades and reaching various standards would take care of themselves. But at the end of the day, to be in a place where they can honestly say that they gave their best effort.
So don't say come home with an A. Say go out there today and do your best.
Exactly.
I see. Now, you've been doing this for a while now. What do you bring to this program that works, do you think?
Well, I think I bring expectations of them to exceed and to excel. I bring commitment and just a real concern and a love and for them as people, as human beings, as young men, as young African-American men who are being faced with a number of challenges in this society. And so I bring myself to that in my own struggle, my own daily struggle to commit myself. So a level of honesty and a sense of transparency, if you will. And I think they respond to that.
But it's more than a pep talk, that word commitment you're using.
Exactly. Exactly. And they sense that. They sense that not only from me, but they can sense commitment and sincerity from anyone, teachers or anyone else they deal with in society. And they respond to that. I think a lot of these young men simply want someone who cares and who cares about them and who accepts them just as they are.
Let's see if we get a call in. Let's go to Jeannie, and Jeannie's with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I teach in a suburban, fairly wealthy suburban school district in an elementary school, and a number of years ago we began a busing program where children from the city who were African-American were bused out to our schools. And at first we were thrilled. We thought, oh good, these kids are going to get out here in a great school and they're going to do fine and we're really going to do our best for them. And we eventually discovered that they weren't doing very well. And I think it was a sort of a shock to us because we are good teachers. Most of us have master's degrees. We've been at it a long time. We're committed to the children. We have a very positive school. And the children weren't doing well. And so I think initially our reaction was to blame the child. Well, they're poor. You know, they come to school behind, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the kids' fault. Well, we've been at this a while, and we finally, I think, began to realize that we are good teachers for white kids and maybe we're not so good teachers for black kids. So we've been looking at that and trying to find ways that we can change our practice to close that achievement gap. We've been working on closing that achievement gap. And, you know, some of your callers have said, well, you just need good teachers to make the difference. Well, we are good teachers and we weren't making the difference.
Jeannie, I'm afraid we're running out of time,
yeah.
So I'm afraid I'm going to have to let you go. But thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome.
And Lawrence Burnley, if you just a few seconds to respond to that.
Yes. Well, I think one of the gaps that your show has not really addressed, there is indeed a gap between culturally rooted gaps. That there are ways people learn and communicate and even teach that's culturally based. And unfortunately, they're particularly for people of color.
And we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We'll go back to this another day. Thank you so much. The Talk of the Nation from NPR News.